this is Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and you're listening to Focus on Community, live from the K2 studio on this really lovely Juneau fall evening. It's just gotten dark, and we've had a pretty wild day of rain and sun and rain and sun, and I just think today couldn't have been a better day. Anyways, we're lucky. But tonight I'll be addressing a pretty somber topic, death by suicide. I believe that once we've reached a certain age, everyone's life has been touched, perhaps even shattered, by the suicide of a relative, a close friend, or someone we know in the community. And I feel it's important to talk about suicide in a public way, such as this hour-long radio show tonight, or at the community forum, like the one I attended in Cake many years ago, when there was a rash of suicides in that southeast Alaskan village. But first, I would like to introduce my two guests. Hyla Wright, who grew up in Juneau and is a school psychologist with the Juneau School District, and with her is Chris Cairns, who works with the Juneau Suicide Prevention Project. Welcome, Hyla and Chris. But before we go any further, I'd like to tell our listeners that this is a live call-in show. We really welcome your comments and questions. And jot this number down. Anytime during the hour, you can call us at 463-6433, and that's obviously area code 907. And we'll get you on the air. But if you do not want to speak on the air, our operator will write down your question and give it to us, and we'll address it. Does that work, tech staff? Okay. I've got pretty good sound engineers in here. So we really do encourage you to call in, and don't worry about interrupting us. We want to hear from you. So I'm going to start with Hyla and ask you, what is your connection to the suicide prevention program in Juneau?
Thanks. Well, I am a school psychologist in my third year with the Juneau School District, but this is actually my second year coordinating the school-based portion of a suicide prevention grant that we have. So Chris is coordinating the community-based portion of that grant. There's a couple different aspects of what I do. Part is we have one new addition as a result of this grant is we have two behavior health specialists, one working at the middle school level and one at the high school level that the grant was able to fund, which we were really excited about because it's basically one more opportunity for us to be able to bring some mental health resources into the school to be able to
give school
support. We have them actually, they work at JDHS, Yakuske, Thunder Mountain, Dryden, and DZ. So we have them actually.
Oh, wow, everywhere.
Yeah, we have a middle school and a high school position. So the middle school is split between the two middle schools, and then the high school person is at both of those high schools.
So that's your position. And Chris, what do you do?
Well, as Hyla said, I coordinate the community-based portion of the grant, which is like promotion and community trainings in suicide intervention. And I'm kind of a Johnny on the spot as far as what the coalition needs. I sit on all of the coalition subcommittees, so I have a hand in a lot of what they do.
Okay. And now what I need, either of you, well, first of all, maybe I'm going to ask, what's a behavioral health specialist? Because some people might call him a counselor. Would you call him a counselor?
They are master's level clinicians.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Yes, but they are filling multiple roles. They are acting as counselors, but also as more kind of mental health like case managers. Part of what we do, especially with all of the freshmen in our district, is we screen them all for signs of depression and suicidal ideation, and once those students are identified, our behavior health specialists continue to, you know, follow up and track them and, you know, ensure that either they're getting support and follow-up outside the school district or from the teen health center, or the behavior health specialists themselves then could be in that counselor role with them.
So you're testing every student in Juneau?
We're screening.
Screening. Screening. Every student in Juneau, did you see?
Yes, with the, in ninth grade. All ninth graders, we do, there is a consent, passive consent form that is sent home so parents would have the opportunity for their student to opt out. But the curriculum, we present a Signs of Suicide curriculum, and that is a part of our school district curriculum, so all students receive that curriculum, and then the screen would follow that.
And the curriculum is in the health class, or...?
It actually, at the high school level, we've kind of been doing it in different classes. It isn't necessarily health. Like, we pick the days and then second or third period, more whichever period of the day. You know, we like to do it kind of before lunch, and so we could have time to do that screen and then have the rest of the day for follow-up. So mm-hmm. It isn't necessarily in a specific class. We actually just structure it.
What do you do? I mean, yeah, I think I remember... reading that perhaps, just like I've specialized in eating disorders in the past, and what you do not do is go into schools and talk about eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that it's teaching them about eating disorders. How do you finesse that around suicide?
Well, what we're mainly doing is helping both students and their peers to identify signs and symptoms of depression. You know, depression is one very treatable, mental health disorder. And so... Mm-hmm. That's mainly what we're treating, is for students to recognize those signs in themselves and in others and be able to appropriately, find ways to be able to get help for themselves or friends.
Okay, so you're really talking about depression.
We do talk about, signs and symptoms of suicidal ideation. We do talk about that, for every 1,000 people mm-hmm. that have the thought of suicide, mm-hmm. someone would actually act mm-hmm. on that thought. But we do talk about signs and symptoms.
Okay. Tell me some, describe other services in the program, other aspects, I should say, of the program.
In the school or outside of the school?
Both.
Okay. In the school, at the middle school level, we have started running some groups. At the middle school level, it's a little different because we don't do screenings. So, we mainly get referrals from concerns from administrators, teachers, counselors, students that are identified as being at risk, even students that are just maybe outliers, students kind of on the edges of the lunchroom that aren't seeming to connect,
mm-hmm.
Finding ways of getting them involved. So whether that's one thing is the groups. Last year they started a couple groups, specifically at Floyd Dryden, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. But then, even things like ping pong tournaments at lunchtime, activity craft tables where they, made Valentines to bring to mm-hmm. some of the elder homes. And basically just trying to find ways to integrate and get involved in the school community.
Okay. And Chris,
So we do a suicide intervention training called Understanding Suicide, Building Intervention Skills. I'd say that's probably the primary way that we interact with the community at large, is people who are interested in receiving that training. It's an hour and a half long, and it's got a lot of substance for an hour and a half long training. It's for a layperson who mm-hmm. maybe not so familiar with behavioral mm-hmm. health that's concerned about mm-hmm. a relative or loved one.
I've seen posters around town. And do many people show up?
That's always a struggle. No, people don't typically show up in great numbers to the public presentations. But what I've been doing is coordinating with places of employment or throwing special functions that make it a lot easier for people to receive the message. I think mm-hmm. it's kind of hard for people to drive across town with the express intent of listening to an hour and a half of suicide intervention.
And I would think that it would be very, very appealing to somebody who was in the throes of dealing with a relative or a friend. But if you weren't in the throes of it, it's like, oh, my gosh, I don't think I want to go talk about that. We'll see how many people turn off the radio tonight because we're talking about suicide.
Okay. Yeah, that's always a struggle. And I think it's about the way in which you sort of brand the message.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that I've really been attempting to do is make it a bit statistical and just sort of interesting in a... interesting to people in ways that that aren't necessarily emotionally vulnerable.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think everybody's interested in, you know, cause of death statistics for the state of Alaska, for example. And just sort of knowing some stuff about the numbers, I think, really allows people to find a way to make it interesting but not dangerous.
I think what's really interesting, and we're going to get there pretty soon, is why people commit suicide and what's the impact on friends, loved ones, community members who are left behind. You run a group. Is this correct, or you're planning on running a group for people who've had a loved one die by suicide?
Yeah, it's in the planning stages right now. The primary facilitator is a local clinician and survivor of suicide loss herself, named Saundra Sexton Jones. And it's just being hung up on Saundra's availability, but that should start within the next month or so.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, at hospice, where I lead a bereavement group, we have, I'd say, in any bereavement group, and let's say we average 10 to 12 people, I lead the group twice a year, we have, I'd say, 3 out of 10 on the average where the death has been by suicide. And it's a brother, it could be a brother, it could be a child, or a parent. And it's really quite frequent that they sign up for that group. So it's great that you're going to be doing another group. That's good. There's a coalition. Tell me about who's in this coalition. What's the coalition about?
So the coalition is a pretty broad-based interagency group that also has community shareholders. It was started back in 2008, I believe, by a school psychologist named Brendan Kiernan.
Oh, I know Brendan.
Yeah, everybody remembers Brendan. Who was responding to, you know, a spate of adolescent suicides. And he was able to secure some grant funding and to I believe his initial purpose was to get the signs of suicide screening that Hyla was discussing we do up on off the ground there. And he was able to secure enough funding for the schools to do it, but then he sort of thought, like, well, okay, so we identify the students, then what sort of services do we offer them, and, you know, how do we go about doing that? So he brought in some, you know, mental health providers, community mental health providers around town, and pretty soon the coalition was born, and it used to be called the Suicide Prevention Task Force. We recently changed our name, but it's really an impressive group of agencies around town. It's sort of like the de facto behavioral health coalition.
It really is, and I'm quite impressed. I think it's very unique in this community. Do you have many people like me from the private practice sector that attend the meetings?
Sure, yeah. We have people stop by all the time. They come in and out, and anybody who's interested in receiving minutes will be added to our mailing list. They're all capable of interfacing with the group through our web pages, www.suicideprevention.org, junosuicideprevention.org, and junomentalhealth.org.
Okay. Elaine,
can I touch on one thing really quick? I'm just reflecting on what you had asked me before. I know it's a little delayed.
Please.
But the question you had asked was, you know, like with self-harming, some of that stuff, that hesitancy to talk about that in the school, one of the things that we're trying to break is that stigma with suicide, that talking about it is going to put the idea in someone's head.
Uh-huh.
And that really, you know, is...
There's no
is
proof
a myth.
Of that.
No, and it is the opposite. I mean, that they are saying that is not true. And so, I mean,
good.
Part of the main aspect of our training is to encourage people to
talk.
If they have concerns about someone, to ask them if they are suicidal, because the idea, you know, it is shown that they're not going to put that idea in someone's head. And so I think that is the hesitancy. There's a lot of stigma about talking about suicide, and really
that's really a good point, Hyla, because I think it is very different from eating disorders. Obviously, someone who's severely depressed knows about suicide. And obviously, bringing it up in a classroom isn't going to teach them about suicide. But I think what it might do is have them feel less ashamed of saying the S word. And then also having their friends cut to the chase a little quicker, rather than dancing around when inquiring about, are you thinking of committing suicide? And often we socially might dance around it, like, are you feeling okay? Or Are you depressed? Because you're almost embarrassed to even suggest the idea that the person would think of committing suicide. And I don't think anybody would be offended if you were off the wall.
No, and that is one of the things that Chris teaches in this training. It is really challenging for people to ask that question. And they actually have people just practice asking that because it is, you know, it is really, it's difficult.
Do you use euphemisms like are you thinking of harming yourself?
We try to shy away from that just so that people know exactly what the question is that they're being asked. Because sometimes people are thinking about harming themselves, but not necessarily
suicide.
Killing
well,
themselves.
With cutting. And with cutting isn't necessarily any sign that the person wants to harm themselves.
Right.
Okay.
So
now, do not forget to call in if you have a comment or a question. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Hyla Wright, a psychologist with the Juneau School District, and Chris Cairns with the Juneau Suicide. Actually, both of them are with the Juneau Suicide Prevention Program. And this program is live on the air tonight, and we invite you to call in with questions or comments. You can call us at 463-6433. I hope I get that right. And we'll, is that correct? Oh, good. And we'll get you on the air. Now, the nice thing is Juneau's a small town, and that's good. But the trouble is that some people don't want their voice recognized on the air. So our operator will be happy to write down your question and give it to us, and we'll address it. Okay. So we have a call coming in, and we're going to wait for that to be transferred over to our main board. And it's complex. And fortunately, we have two expert technicians here who are able to do that. And what we'd like is a system that where the phone was easier to use because everybody here in the studio has to really work hard to get these phone calls on the air. And maybe John is taking a message. So I'm going to continue on with our program until we hear that they will. I'll interrupt when we get the caller on the air. Now, I'd like to explore with both of you one of the most, I'd say, profound and perplexing issues concerning suicide. And that is the question of why. But I need to get headphones on. And when I do, would you hand me that, Chris? Okay, I think we have somebody on the air. Hello, this is Elaine. Can you hear me? I guess I don't know if it's working. Excuse our technology here. Oh, okay. I don't think we have him on the air. So anyways, the big question is why? Why would people, and I know there's no monolithic answer because there are different reasons for different people. John, are we on the air? Okay, he's going to give me different headphones. And we'll give it a try with these headphones. Hello, are you on the air? Can you hear me? Unfortunately, it's not working. John's playing around with this. Just hold on to whoever has called, and we'll try to get you on. Okay. Are you there? Looks like we're having difficulty. Why don't you take the message or the comment and write it down, John, and then we'll go from there. So the question is why. Do you want to start off, Hyla?
Yeah. You know, another part of this training and some of the actually studies they've done of people who have attempted suicide
Hello?
And survived those suicide attempts are that the answer from a lot of them is that they didn't know a way out of the pain that they were in. They did not necessarily want to kill themselves, but they just did not know how to get out of the state
the
that
suffering.
They were in.
And the suffering.
You know, and I think it's one of those things that we can't fully understand unless we're in that situation.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's kind of my best understanding that I can have is just that for them, that's just the only way out that they can see.
And what kind of suffering are we talking about here? Are you talking about?
Well, let's try this one time.
Should we keep going?
Okay. Yeah.
And if not, I'm going to have you call.
Well, I do think that, you know, one of the most common is just, you know, very severe depression. I mean, I think, you know, that for a lot of people, you know, the depression that they're in is just, you know, majorly interfering with their ability to function. I think they're in a lot of pain, I think.
Hello?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really know the answer.
let's just take a look at depression. It appears to me that I would wonder if there's a difference in the rate of suicide between countries that have free counseling and free health care, which is every affluent country in the world except the United States, because for a lot of people, it's impossible to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. We're going to try being on the air. Hold on. We're going to give it another try. I'm on this one. Hello.
Yes,
can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you?
Oh, I am so excited that our technicians got you on the air. What can
I
do for you?
I've been up here for 25 years. I moved up from Phoenix. And down in Phoenix, I work for a group called Phoenix South Community Health, which had a teen prevention suicide health deal, suicide line, where we trained adolescents to be suicide prevention experts. And there was always an adult there that if the teen got into trouble, they could always put one of us on. But it seemed very successful in peers helping peers in suicide prevention. Why can't that be done here in Juneau?
Well, I'm going to ask Hyla Wright to answer that.
I just caught the tail end of that question. I heard about peer-to-peer programs. Is that what you're referring to?
It was very successful here. We were in Phoenix, where I moved up here from.
And it's actually great to hear you say that. I actually just got back from this last week. I was up in Anchorage for a statewide grantee meeting. And, you know, there definitely are areas up there. The benefit of going to this is we get to hear about these other programs that really are working. And, you know, one of the things, there are definitely programs even that we're looking at buying that are going to implement aspects of that. Just as it is right now, our biggest goal for this year is to bring peers into this and to have them taking a leadership role in, you know, basically teaching and working with their peers. I mean, I guess that it absolutely is the direction that we're wanting to go in. I mean, I think what we've established right now is kind of a system of screening and identifying students, but I do think that peer-led programs and
Is there some evidence then that peer-led programs are very effective?
Sources of Strength is one program that I've heard about specifically, especially up north, that has been started in some communities. One example that I heard this last week was a school district where, like once a month, basically each month they have themes that they rotate through. One is like connection to family the next month, and they would have events that was really focusing and strengthening that connection with family the next month, maybe community involvement. That's one program I know specifically that we have been looking at.
Okay, and to our caller, is there any, that was a very good comment. Anything else you'd like to say?
No, I was just wondering, you know, why Juneau wasn't doing it. It was so successful in Phoenix.
Well,
yeah. Do you know if Phoenix was a specific? Do you know if it was a specific program, or do you know any specific aspect?
Well, I work for a community. It's no longer around. I don't think from friends I have still down there. It was the agency I worked for was Phoenix Community or Phoenix South Community Mental Health.
Okay.
And they were the ones who had the peer suicide prevention hotline, and the phone number was, you know, put all over Phoenix.
Okay.
And teenagers who were in trouble called in and had peer counseling, which was a lot more helpful than I think an adult saying, well, you know, you have to do this to prevent suicide and all that.
Right.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I really appreciate you saying that, and that absolutely is the direction that we're wanting to go. Chris, do you want to talk a little bit about, just really quickly about Megan, what is happening with the youth?
In a second. Sorry. I just want to thank our caller. So
okay, well, just so he knows, this is about that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
so just
listening,
to give him,
because
yeah,
Chris
you.
Is going to explain some related services here in Juneau. Thank you to our caller. Goodbye.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
So one of our grants administrators is a man named James Galanos, and he and a pretty much my position at Search, this woman by the name of Megan Gregory are developing a youth gatekeeper model, which is a peer-led suicide intervention training, and they're hoping to make it about 20 minutes long. So just something that could really easily fit into any sort of classroom schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just develop, you know, some gatekeepers that are of that demographic, and research shows that, you know, kids are much more willing to hear information
other
from
kids.
Yeah, from
and
their,
they do have a youth coalition.
You mean here in Juneau, you have a youth coalition?
Well, Search is actually working. Search has a
which is just explained. Southeast Alaska Regional Health Corporation. It's our native health corporation.
Right. They have a suicide prevention coalition, as well as a coalition that addresses a couple other societal ills. But that's called the One Is Too Many Coalition. And it's throughout all of Southeast, and they are getting a group of youth delegates together to be youth ambassadors. They're going to be like leaders within their community, and three or four times a year they'll all fly into Juneau and go to kind of a symposium, I guess, on different issues and educate them on ways to be, you know, leaders in their own community.
Okay, good. We're going to take a little break now, and what we're going to do is hear some jazz. I think it's Brazilian jazz, just for a slight change of pace. So are you ready to go, John? Thanks. We'll be right back.
Embola, bola, embora sem rebolar. 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 Passo nessa vida como passo na avenida, entre nobres e caras de pau, sufocados no mesmo ideal, mas à mercê de um falso alento eu me deito esperando, sorrindo ou xingando, o que jamais teceu-me consideração, dança quem marcou, eu não. Caterete paê, caterete, catere, cate, caterete paê. Caterete, catere, cate. Embola, bola, embora sem rebolar. 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 Passo nessa vida como passo na avenida, entre nobres e caras de pau, sufocados no mesmo ideal, mas à mercê de um falso alento, eu me deito esperando, sorrindo ou xingando, o que jamais teceu em consideração, dança quem marcou, eu não. Caterete paê, caterete, caterete. Cate, caterete paê, caterete, caterete, cate, caterete paê, caterete, caterete, cate, caterete paê, caterete, caterete, cate, caterete paê.
Welcome back to Focus on Community. Sometimes also my show sometimes the kid around it call it Ask Dr. E. Well, I'm Elaine Schroeder, Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Hyla Wright, a psychologist with the Juneau School District, and Chris Cairns, who works with NAMI and the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition. Both, my guests, are with the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition. And we're live on the air, and we really encourage you, now that we've got the technology down, we'd like to invite you to call us in with questions or comments. You can call us at 463-6425. What is the number? 463? We had to change the numbers. So John is writing it down for me so I get it correctly. And we'll get you on the air. Or John or Dolly can write your question down and we'll read it on the air. And here's the correct number. 463-6433 is the correct number. 463-6433. So do give us a call. We're just starting to talk about the causes of suicide, and Hila highlighted the one that we most think of, which is depression. Could you speak to some of the other underlying causes? I mean, a lot of things can make you depressed. So what are the other underlying causes of hopelessness, despair?
I think that they can be situational. I think, you know, people could find themselves in a situation that they can't see their way out of, whether it was, a medical situation, legal or family situation. I think sometimes, people can get to a place where they just can't see options or ways out.
Yeah. Yeah. And not be depressed particularly, but be scared.
Scared.
Really scared.
Mm-hmm.
Chronic pain. We have a group going on right now at the hospital that's a stress reduction program for people with chronic illnesses and chronic pain or chronic stress or just even everyday stress. It's the stress reduction program at Bartlett, and I've worked a lot with chronic pain, and it's really hard. And an individual could feel like they've just reached the end of the road. And that there's nothing that can stop it. They've tried everything. Addictions. What about addictions? Addictions, I think, add into the depression. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's a combination of the two, because you get the hopelessness where someone has tried over and over and over again to give up their addiction and have failed repeatedly and repeatedly. And again, of course, it's not easy to go into long-term treatment because it's very expensive.
A high percentage of suicide attempts, do involve drug or alcohol use. I mean, I think the two really do end up hand in hand.
Do you think that's because the person is addicted or because they are going to take pills? What do you think?
I think it could be a combination. I think the addiction could lead up to that, but I think that sometimes, an altered state could make that an easier step for someone.
Absolutely. So if you're just in mm-hmm. an altered state of consciousness, mm-hmm. really out of it.
The national statistic says that one-third of suicides involve alcohol in some way.
Yes.
In Alaska, we actually don't do toxicology screens any longer on suicides. But the number that I heard last was that it was about half here. So I think that definitely plays a role in our suicides. It's just that the judgment-suppressing qualities of alcohol, I think.
Very good.
Yeah, and I think there's a certain level of impulsiveness to acting on suicidal ideation.
Mm-hmm. You had talked about pills or medications. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes another thing that we had discussed is that, oftentimes someone who has been dealing with, some mental health issues, when they will go and actually get on some, either antidepressants or other mm-hmm. medication, sometimes that actually, elevates their mood enough that it brings them enough out of that deep depression that they actually are motivated enough to have enough energy that then sometimes in that situation or case, they will go ahead and follow through with.
Mm-hmm. And chronic mental illness,
mm-hmm.
Severe mental illness. I think one of the hardest things for all of us to understand is why a young child would take their own life. There are suicides among 10-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Well, they are saying that suicide is the third leading cause of death for ages of 10 to 14, was one of the more recent statistics that I had seen. I think there's multiple factors. I think nationwide, we have seen aspects of bullying and, specifically even cyberbullying playing in some situations to mm-hmm. Teen and youth suicides. My guess is that most likely, some trauma and abuse.
Yes.
And
that would be, aside from sheer mental illness, it would be trauma and abuse. And Chris just mentioned the ACEs study couple of months ago, I had Gary Weglars, who used to work for Search and now is with Hospice. And we talked about the ACEs study. Chris, do you want to give the gist of it?
Sure. So there are the study was done, I believe, down at a Kaiser Permanente.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, down in Southern California. About 10 years ago, is that right?
Yeah,
Sorry. Kind of forgetting
with
some of the facts.
With a huge population.
Huge population. And they charted a couple different childhood stressors.
Yes.
And
I think there were 10 in all.
10, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were like growing up poor, one or more parent incarcerated.
Yes, incarceration, substance abuse at home, mm-hmm. sexual abuse, divorce.
And this is all like before the age of 5, I believe.
I don't remember that.
So it's a cutoff of some. It's early childhood.
I don't remember that
experiences,
but, yeah.
but
and they're asking adults these questions. These are adults looking back at their history, and
they found out that it was actually the number of these 1 through 10 experiences, the greater, the more you had towards 10, the greater your likelihood of attempting suicide was.
And every health problem and mental mm-hmm. health, physical and health problem.
Correlated.
Everything. Mm-hmm. And they even controlled, for example, smoking. So maybe what they thought is, well, people growing up in poverty are more likely to smoke, and then they're more likely to die of lung cancer. They removed all the smokers or obesity. They removed all that. And still, the main, and I really feel this as a clinician, I mean, there is no question, the vast majority of people who are suffering psychologically have histories of difficult, very difficult situations, and correlated, the more difficult, the more suffering. Of course, many exceptions to that rule, so I don't want to say that because someone is depressed or has a diagnosis of bipolar that they necessarily grew up in an abusive family. Not at all. Let's just say the numbers, your risk of having anxiety, depression, and obviously suicide ideation greatly increase. It's when you see the graphs with the ACE study, mm-hmm. for example, if you check off one thing, then it goes up a little. Two things, it goes up again. Three things. And so this is what I see in my office, because I'm working mainly with adults. And so you're working a lot with children. And it's interesting because your screening tool is screening for depression, but it's not screening for abuse.
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be very difficult, because you would have to do so many reports. It would be, I mean, there's an obvious shying away, because if you're looking for suicide, you know, potential or depression, it would be really screening for neglect and abuse, and particularly sexual abuse. So, you mentioned when I was talking to you earlier, the contagion effect. Could you talk a little bit about that, either one of you?
Yes. Well, it's one thing that after a death by suicide, there really are steps that need to be taken to prevent contagion, which would be the likelihood of follow-up suicides after that event. And there's things like not glorifying the situation, especially publicly. It's something that we work closely with the media to ensure that information is presented factually just in ways, that doesn't glorify the situation.
What about rock stars who commit suicide? I mean, that's a tough one.
So there's actually an interesting study that's been done back in the 50s when Marilyn Monroe died
uh-huh.
by suicide.
Yeah.
There was quite a few, there was a big contagion effect to that, and they definitely glamorized her in their reporting. There was always the pictures of her all with her makeup on and, looked very beautiful. And then Kurt Cobain in mm-hmm. the 90s died by suicide, and there actually was not that same contagion effect. And they believe that it's because of the way the media represented both of them.
Aha. Uh-huh. And remind me, how was it represented with Kurt Cobain?
Well, I guess it was that he was not, it didn't look like he was a happy person.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody that you did all want to emulate.
Right.
What about the contagion effect with, okay, you got a high school. I don't know if you have this data, but let's say in the past 10 years, how many do you know school children have committed suicide? Do you know, or how many a year? I mean, do you have any idea of the numbers?
What I do know is there haven't been any during the school year since in the last 5 years since we started this mm-hmm. effort. I don't actually know the overall numbers. I know that the year prior to them starting, I know they're...
Because I wonder about the contagion effect mm-hmm. of that. Art isn't the most likely group, the group with the highest number of suicides. Young adult males, like 18 to 24?
16 to 24.
16 to 24.
Males, native males, is the highest demographic in the state.
And what about our state compared to other states?
That's what makes Alaska unique, is that we have a problem with suicide in our young.
So that's not as common in other places?
No, not at all.
And why do you think it's young adult native males?
Well, I mean, first of all, as we talk about this, you know, Alaska is a huge state, and there's, you know, a lot of differences, you know, I think area to area. One thing that was, you know, also discussed this last week is, and more in northern communities a lot, I think just all around, historically, with, you know, in Alaska Native communities, the men really were the providers for their families, you know, whether that was, you know, hunting, you know, just all around providing resources and took care of their families. And I think, you know, currently most of the jobs that have come into those communities within those cultures are viewed as more typically kind of female or women
yeah.
jobs. And yeah. so they describe that most of their men have kind of lost their role. And that's what I, you know, even this last week, I was in one kind of small focus group discussing this, and just that, you know, then there's a difference in role models and what they look up to, and that sometimes there's a kind of a crisis of identity.
Of course, of course. And then you have the historical trauma,
mm-hmm.
the trauma of the boarding schools, and in a training I just took in Juneau put on by Central Council, Clinkett and Haida. A movie they showed estimated that 90% of the children in boarding schools for Natives or Canadian First Nation people were sexually abused. And so we also know that if you grow up in an institution, you do not have role modeling for parents. So that shameful time in our history in Alaska and of course in Canada as well, I think is more than a partial explanation. I think it's just a huge background of why young adult males, and then add on the loss of role, racism, and you've got a pretty potent soup there for despair. And I remember when I was in Hawaii one time, I was reading a Hawaiian history book of the first white incursions into Hawaii, where the religious and cultural fabric of society was very quickly torn apart, very quickly, and that people would just walk into the sea in despair. And it was committing suicide. They just walk into the sea. So, some people believe that there's people may attempt suicide but not really mean it, and it's a cry for help. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, you definitely find that attitude frequently. I personally have never observed that to be the case. I know that especially young people, the younger people that I've shared information with, see suicidal ideation as sort of attention-seeking behavior. And I, you know, try to turn that around a bit and say, well, it is attention-needing behavior.
Good.
Yeah.
I really like that. Because the way I feel when a parent calls me and says, well, I don't know what to do, because sometimes a very troubled teenager will threaten suicide over and over again. If you don't stop this, I'll kill myself, or you're killing me, and they don't know what to do. And so then the parent will call and say, you know, I don't know what to do. I don't know if she's really serious. And I just say it doesn't matter. What matters is that she is deeply suffering, and it's not about blaming anybody. If she's threatening suicide, whether or not she's going to carry it out, makes no difference at this. I mean, bring her in, and she needs help, right? I mentioned earlier about access to services, and since psychotherapy is very expensive, and we really have limited sliding scale in this town, what is one to do if parents are poor, and they have a child, or they themselves are severely depressed? Where do you go?
Well, I mean, I think, do you want to talk about the Caroline as a first step? And then...
Sure. So we have a service here in Alaska that's a 24-hour crisis line called the Alaska Caroline. It's located in Fairbanks, and it's sponsored by the state, so much so that if you were to call the National Suicide Prevention Crisis or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, that will forward you to the Alaska Caroline if you're within our state borders.
Mm-hmm.
The Caroline is a crisis intervention line, which is not defined by them. It's defined by the caller. So it's appropriate to call them in all circumstances, I guess, if you're experiencing any sort of a crisis, which means that you don't have to be someone necessarily that is experiencing suicidal ideation or suicidal intent. You could be, you know, the mother of that child who is saying that they're going to commit suicide. That's appropriate to call. So that's a cheap, you know, that's a free 24-hour option.
And who answers the phone?
A counselor. And I believe it's 24 hours, and someone at the, I don't know how many clinicians they have, but they're all clinicians that answer.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And they have for youth actually recently started a text line so that youth actually could text instead of in. But that's just a side note.
Yeah. Well, then what? Okay. So then, let's face it. Then the person at on the other end of the line says, let's say your child needs to see a mental health clinician, and that is not easy. And for example, let's see, Hila, one of you, works for Juno Youth Services, and that's it's hard to get in right away.
Well, but Juno Youth Services, though, does have, you know, a risk screening. I mean,
good.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a parent could bring their student into Juno Youth Services, and they do, even a certain number of them, they do for no charge. And so,
good.
I mean,
okay,
absolutely, so that would be a recommendation, is to bring them in for a risk screening
for
Juno Youth Services.
Okay. We're nearing the end of our show, but I'd like to have one more little song. And then what we'll finish up is we'll talk about the people who are left behind and what kind of services for them. We've already mentioned the bereavement group at hospice, but we'll take a look at some of the impacts of suicide on other people. Okay?
Dizer que você fica mais bonita desse jeito, ou daquele, quem sou eu? Quem sou eu? Pra falar mal do seu gosto, da pintura no seu rosto, quem sou eu? Não sou ninguém. Cada um trata de si. seus olhos parecem dizer: muito bem, eu prefiro não falar para não contrariar você. Fico no meu samba, se quiser pode ficar. Vou lá na Portela, mesmo que você não vá. Não darei ouvidos se você me provocar, mas aceito um beijo se você quiser me dar. Se você quiser me dar.
Okay, welcome back, and I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder with Hyla Wright and Chris Cairns, both of whom are active with the Juno Suicide Prevention Program, and we're winding up the show now with taking a look at the family members, the good friends of people who are left behind by people who die by their own hand, by people who die by suicide. And I don't know who, just some thoughts on that. What is the impact?
Oh, it's devastating. You know, it's a isolating pain that, you know, people that is responsible for a lot of secondary societal ills. You know, people will develop their own depression or their own substance abuse issues to cope with the loss of their loved one. There's a stigma associated with suicide that survivors must confront. Like a lot of times, like spouses will feel guilty or will feel a sense of blame from the community. Mm-hmm. They weren't able to prevent their loved one from taking their own life.
Right.
And it's a huge problem. They say that most recently I read the Suicide Prevention Resource Center released data that says that 85% of us within our lifespan will be primary or secondary survivor of suicide.
You mean either, what's primary or secondary?
So either an immediate family member of ours will die by suicide or one of their immediate family members will die by suicide.
Oh, okay. And that's not even including friends.
No.
Because when Hyla and I were preparing for this program the other day, it just brings up all the people in our lives. And, I mean, it's a handful, but it's I think back to when I was 22 and I hung out with a group of other women, young women in grad school. And one of them, who wasn't real close to me, committed suicide, I'll tell you, nobody got it. Because I think this is important to say. There are times when there isn't a clue that that's what the person's going to do. There are times. But now back on the guilt, in those times, I mean, it's extremely difficult. One of the things that I think is useful in counseling, when I work with people who are seriously depressed and have flirted with suicide, I say if they have a family and they all, everybody has a family, but family, friends, I explain how devastating it is to others. And I have had people say, I didn't know that. I thought they'd be better off without me. Which, have you heard that before?
Oh, definitely.
People would be better off without me. And what is the, do you know what the relative incidence is if your own parent committed suicide, that their children would commit suicide?
I don't offhand, but I do know that it's increased above the average.
Yeah, so that would be another painful ripple effect, that you would be ensuring that your own children had a higher risk, not that they would, but had a higher risk. Because then the role modeling would be that the way you cope with seemingly intractable problems would be to end your life. Right.
Right.
And you don't have any support services right now, is that correct, for people?
Well, we've put together, the Suicide Postvention Committee is basically finalizing a survivor's packet, and basically that would be a packet of, you know, information, resources, that we would be able to provide to those survivors. The one benefit of the coalition is, you know, we really have established a network, especially in Juneau being a smaller community, that, in the aftermath of a suicide, you know, our goal is to not be intrusive as to, you know, showing up and knocking on someone's door and trying to provide them with this information, is to be able to network within the community, throughout our own connections, to find either, you know, someone who knows that family well or a natural connection to that family to find out if they are wanting, you know, resources, support information, access, to support from even potentially other survivors. So that's been a goal of ours.
That would
be
wonderful, to have that peer group support.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes all the difference. What I've been able to do with the bereavement group occasionally is to connect somebody who was in a previous group and who was, let's say, a young mother survivor of a death. Not, we're not talking about suicide, but just her husband died suddenly, with another woman who's been widowed with children, and I think it's in some ways so much better than counseling, because as one of my bereavement group women said, will I survive this? Is there light at the end of the tunnel? And of course, a parent whose child has committed suicide, a wife or husband whose spouse has committed suicide, you wonder, I mean, that just shatters their life. And can they put the pieces back together again? And that peer hookup would be absolutely amazing. I think that I'd really suggest you go for that. We're going to wind up the show in a second. And I'd like to thank you both for coming in on this really nice night, because it's not raining in Juneau, which is amazing. So thank you both. And I also want to thank our support staff. So I want to thank Dolly and John Kramers, who come on my Monday nights. Do you come every Monday night to do this? Are you? No. Do you just come once a month?
Well, almost every Monday.
Almost every Monday. And it's an amazing service, and they're also the folks behind the among the folks behind the Marie Drake Planetarian shows. So they're great, and to figure out this board and do all this for me, I've grown very fond of them. So thank you all. We'll be back in a month, and thank you for tuning in to K2 Focus on Community.
You're listening to KTOO FM, Juno's 20. 20-